Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Horseshoe crab spawning season brings crab harvesters back to Kitsummit, reigniting debate over its status as a horseshoe crab sanctuary.
You might see this as being an irresistible force confronting an immovable object. The conservationists clearly aren't going away anytime soon. But at the same time, you've got folks like these residents in Kitsummit who are saying, well, they don't see any issue with continuing to harvest.
Contributor John Hurdle examines the harvesting issue at Kitsummit and its impact. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about the new Delaware State Police Highway Safety Unit. Arts Playlist examines expansion of the University of Delaware's Performing Arts Education Program. And History Matters explores the early years of the U.S. Air National Guard. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this year, contributor John Hurdle examined questions about the harvesting of horseshoe crabs last year during their annual spawning season, specifically in Kitsummit, where several conservationists said harvesters violated state rules in a town that touts itself as a horseshoe crab sanctuary. With a new spawning season underway, John visited Kitsummit last week to see what's happening this year and how harvesting there and elsewhere could be affecting the horseshoe crab population, and with it, spawning shorebirds that rely on their eggs for food. John's piece is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to delve into his reporting. So, John, let's start with some background. Kitsummit is designated as part of a horseshoe crab sanctuary, but recently that status has come into question. First of all, let's explain what a horseshoe crab sanctuary is and what that means.
Well, the horseshoe crab sanctuary was set up by a Dover-based nonprofit called the Ecological Research and Development Group. And the sanctuary was set up in 1999, and it consists of about 10 coastal communities along about 15 miles of Delaware Bay shoreline. What the sanctuary seeks is the buy-in of residents in their community. And what the folks who sign up for this thing agree not to allow horseshoe crab harvesting on or near their land, and not to what's called harden the waterline by building bulkheads or maybe installing riprap that would prevent horseshoe crabs spawning on the beaches, because the crabs need sandy beaches to do so.
But starting last year, some harvesting was done at Kitsummit, and that is continuing this year. How is that allowed, and what are they permitted harvesters to do?
Well, the problem with the sanctuary is that it's not legally recognized by DENREC. And so it kind of exists alongside official state regulation. So what DENREC allows is that people can buy into the sanctuary or not. It's up to them. And if they choose not to, then they are allowed to permit the harvesting of horseshoe crabs on their properties by folks who are licensed to collect those crabs. And if those folks can produce written permission from the landowners. So that's why some folks in Kitsummit, for one, are able to allow the harvesting of horseshoe crabs, even though the conservationists in that community anyway consider that they are part of this sanctuary.
So you had a chance to talk to some of the residents who are allowing harvesting on their property. Why are they saying that they're willing to do this, to say, yeah, we're going to allow some licensed harvesters on our property in spite of this overall effort for the town to want to be a sanctuary?
Well, what they say is that number one, it creates jobs. A small number of harvesters have been into Kitsummit last season and this season, and to my knowledge, it's one family, and there are several members of that family who go on the beach and pick up horseshoe crabs, take them off in their pickup truck, and sell them to an industrial concern that then sells them to the commercial fishing industry. And the folks that I talked to said, well, in their view, there's nothing wrong with these harvesters picking up male crabs. And by the way, the harvest of female crabs is not allowed anywhere in the Delaware Bay. And so the harvesters pick up the male crabs, and they make some kind of a living by doing that. And so these private landowners in Kitimat, there are apparently just four of them who have issued their permission for the harvesters to go on their land. They say, well, there's no reason to deny this.
So in addition to kind of this tension between whether or not to even allow any of this harvesting to go on, there were some issues raised last year that harvesters were kind of straying from where they were permitted to work or harvesting more than they were allowed. Are there any indications that that is happening this year? And what kind of response is coming from DENREC that, as you noted, is kind of charged with enforcing the overall rules about harvesting?
Well, there are no complaints this year that I heard from conservationists in the Kitimat community that the harvesters are straying onto land that they should not. In fact, when I visited Kitimat Beach about a week ago, there were actual physical lines in the sand that had been over about an approximately 400-yard stretch of beach, which is adjacent to the homes of the folks who have given their permission. So the idea of these lines is to make sure that the harvesters stay within their bounds, if you like. And this may reflect the fact that DENREC seems to be stepping up its enforcement. I mean, it got a lot of criticism from the conservation community last year for allegedly not enforcing all of the rules that it should have done. And what I heard from one of the harvesters this year is that DENREC police showed up on the very first day of the harvesting season, which was just June 10th, and to make sure that the harvesters had their licenses and that they had their letters from the landowners to say, yeah, it's okay, you can come onto our land.
But some conservationists are suggesting that this harvesting in Kitimat is already having a negative impact based on what happened last year. What are they saying about what's happening to the horseshoe crab population and the effect it's having by allowing this harvesting in areas like Kitimat?
Well, you know, the conservationists that I've spoken to say that the vast majority of horseshoe crabs were removed from the beach during last year's spawning season. And they suspect, I think they don't have any proof of this, but they suspect that this may account for the lower number of horseshoe crabs that have been found on the beach this year. And that, by the way, tends to be supported by the harvesters. One of those that I spoke to said that she has a daily limit of 3,000 horseshoe crabs that she's allowed to collect, but over the course of several days, she hadn't come anywhere near that. And so that tends to support the conservationists' claim that there's a shortage of crabs on the beach this year.
Consequently, that also can have an impact, at least according to conservationists, on the shorebirds that use those horseshoe crab eggs for food. What do we know about where the red knot numbers and all stand and how that could connect here?
Well, indeed, red knots, of course, are fed by the horseshoe crab eggs that the birds come in. Not only red knots, but other shorebirds as well. They come in on migration from this massive long migration from South America to Arctic Canada every year, and they depend on the horseshoe crab eggs to sort of fuel their migration and allow them to get up to their breeding grounds. And so this is one of the concerns that the conservation community has. You know, the two species, horseshoe crabs and red knots, are very tightly linked. One of the concerns here is that red knots are declining because Delaware continues to allow the harvest of horseshoe crabs. And that argument tends to be supported this year by the fact that just a small proportion, less than 5% of the total number of red knots that migrated through Delaware Bay this year, less than 5% of those were seen in Delaware. The rest, of course, were in New Jersey. But it should also be stated that the overall total of migrating red knots was down pretty significantly in 2024 compared with 2023. And so there's still a concern there that these birds are actually headed for extinction.
And one option for attacking any impact that horseshoe crab population and harvesting could have onshore birds like the red knot would be an outright state ban on harvesting like New Jersey has. But that continues to lack strong support in Delaware, correct?
Well, that appears to be the case, yes. Delaware Audubon and its allies are pressing state lawmakers to pass a bill that would actually ban the harvest of horseshoe crabs in Delaware waters for bait. And in so doing, it would follow the ban that New Jersey's had in place since 2008. But there's no indication of any such bill being introduced at the moment.
What's in place now? What else could happen on the federal side of things that could address this issue?
Well, one of the policies is operated by something called the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, and they set quotas for the harvest of horseshoe crabs in the bay, and they leave it up to the bay states to enforce those. So the Delaware's quota for horseshoe crab harvest this year is about 169,000. And we need to emphasize here that these are male crabs only. The commission previously considered lifting a ban on the female horseshoe crab harvest, but then backed away from that starting in the 2023 season because they said they recognized that there was a lot of public concern over the fate of the red knot, and so they left that ban in place. The other possible federal action going on here is that a number of naturalist groups, including Delaware Audubon, have asked the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, to list the horseshoe crab as a threatened or endangered species. We don't know yet whether NOAA's going to do that. They are expected to say sometime soon whether they're going to submit that request to their kind of listing process, but we don't know. So there are two potentially protective measures.
So, John, based on the people you've talked to about what's happening at Kitsummit, does it seem like horseshoe crab harvesting may see more attention in the coming years, and perhaps there might be some momentum gathering for more action on this front?
Well, you might see this as being an irresistible force confronting an immovable object. I mean, the conservationists clearly aren't going away anytime soon, and I think it's pretty likely that the environmental advocates in Delaware are going to continue to press for a bill in the legislature to ban the horseshoe crab harvest. On red knots, there have been, you know, the number of red knots going through the bay is beginning to has edged up a bit in the last few years, but it's still very far below the numbers that came through the bay annually up until in the 80s and perhaps the early 90s. But at the same time, you've got folks like these residents in Kitsummit who are saying, well, they don't see any issue with continuing to harvest the horseshoe crabs, especially the male horseshoe crabs, as long as the harvesters comply with the law. So I think it's unclear as to whether we're going to see any further protections for the horseshoe crab, but we're going to watch this space.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece updating horseshoe crab harvesting issues in the first state is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We chat with Delaware State Police about their new highway safety unit created to help make first state roadways safer as we head into one of the busiest travel periods of the year. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Summer officially begins this week, and that means one of the busiest travel periods of the year is here as people hit the road for vacations. In Delaware, the state police have created a new highway safety unit in an effort to cut down on car accidents and educate the public on driving safety. Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon recently spoke with Sergeant Lloyd McCann and Master Corporal Lewis Briggs with the state police about this new highway safety unit and how it plans to make first state roadways safer.
Mike, the Delaware State Police has a new highway safety unit, the HSU. Why introduce this unit now?
So the unit just formally started, but it was kind of a concept from a few years ago that was part of Governor Carney's highway safety package that passed. And the highway safety unit was just a portion of that. It's finally just hit to the point where we can stand the unit up and start making progress with it that way.
Right. And so nothing specifically happened to spur this, the creation of the HSU. It's just a part of that package, kind of a long time in the making, essentially.
So, like I said, it's part of the package, but there's obviously been an increase in motor vehicle collisions as well as fatal collisions. So it's kind of twofold. Obviously, we want to make the road safer in general, but we also want to reduce the number of collisions, specifically fatal collisions, because there's the most impactful since someone loses a life. So, like I said, it's kind of twofold that it's part of that package to make the road safer, but mainly targeting, collision reduction.
Right, and I was going to ask about that. It seems, obviously the general trend of highway accidents and incidents is higher in Delaware than the state would like. I'm sure other states would say the same. In terms of the unit itself, then HSU will be made up of an 11-person unit. I'm curious just what the, why that specific amount for the unit and what exactly then
I
will.
don't know where, I don't know where the number they came, they just came up with that. I'm included in that 11, so it's really 10 plus one. But I don't know where, where, like I said, that number came from. But that's what we've been dealt, so I'll take it. But we are a statewide unit, so we need obviously more than two people. So 10, I feel like, is a good number to at least start, and we can always expand later on. But the way it was passed through legislation, it was the 11th person is what they were allocated for. But like I said, I don't know where that number, how they came up with that number, but that's what we have.
Well then what's the main focus then for that? What exactly will this the 10 plus 1, what will you be doing? What's the focus there?
So our focus is to impact driving behavior, whether that means you get pulled over and you get a ticket, or that means you get, pulled over and you get a warning. So it's not just, we're outriding tickets. There's education's a big portion of it. Then obviously, handing out safety items to them, things like that, that we have different resources to pull from, DelDOT or Office of Highway Safety. Use them, their partners in this unit as well.
Corporal Riggs, we can bring you into this a little bit. In terms of locations, are there any specific areas or roadways that HSU will particularly key in on?
The primary locations are going to be I-495, 95, and 295. And in addition to that, wherever the superintendent's office, along with the Department of Transportation and our other partners, identifies areas to be doing some proactive highway safety. So it's not all going to be on the interstates in Newcastle County. They can be on. It's going to be encompass all of Route 1 from throughout the entire state, as well as any other roadways or highways that have been identified by respective troop areas for crash reduction and for education and enforcement. And to add to something that Sergeant McCann said earlier, in reference to the education, that is a very important aspect of the highway safety units. It's not just the enforcement, it's some emphasis put on the education with new drivers and current drivers through different avenues. And one avenue is through the schools, which our troopers do now. We're just going to step that up a little bit for our newer drivers.
Earlier this year, the federal government, this might be a bit of a sidebar question here, but earlier this year, the federal government decided to ban or to put a ban on funny or catchy roadside messages, which means, no more jokes or puns or what have you about road safety on Delaware roadways come 2026, I believe. So, again, this could be a bit of a sidebar, but what do you think about that as far as, the larger focus on educating drivers so they can be the best they possibly can be on roadways and focused? Is that something where you look at something like that and it kind of one thing kind of feeds another?
As far as the roadside signs that we see on the roadways, that the state police, we don't have anything to do with that. I can't speculate as to what the Department of Transportation does with that. But I will agree that they are kind of catchy when we all see them, especially on May the 4th. The education portion will be going through not just the Highway Safety Unit, but our Community Engagement Unit. We have our Community Engagement Unit goes out to community events. So they'll be providing some educational material to the guests and to the people that come up to us there, as well as in the schools. And with DLDOT, different things that they're at. Because this, as Sergeant McCann said, and we've already said, is this isn't just a state police program. We're the ones that are doing the Highway Safety Unit, but we are collaborating with the Department of Transportation and the Office of Highway Safety to get that message out. And it goes hand in hand with our Click It or Ticket program that we participate in. That's a nationwide program, and other safe driving initiatives that we do throughout the year.
Yeah, would you be able to speak to that that kind of collaborative that collaboration with DLDOT and then the Office of Highway Safety in Delaware? Do you have anything to add in terms of how that, you know, the collaboration will work?
Well, the department, I can't speculate as to exactly how it's going to work. I don't have the inner workings. I'm sorry, Sarge, do you?
So, yeah, I mean, we're partners. Initially, DLDOT is providing some of the funding, you know, for equipment purchases, things like that. Obviously, Office of Highway Safety is a huge resource when it comes to educational materials, you know, any kind of DUI enforcement or anything we would need there. Down the line, we might use a DLDOT truck to sit on the side of the road and write speeding tickets using a DLDOT truck as like a decoy. You know, you never know what it could be. So they're open to a lot of different things. Obviously, we have to kind of keep people guessing. So for the length of this unit's entirety, we'll have to obviously change things and keep evolving over the years. But like I said, initially, it's, you know, DLDOT has purchased some stuff to kind of get the ball rolling. But what that looks, you know, 5 years from now, I'm not sure.
Right. Well, this is all very timely, especially heading into the summer season. But, you know, just as we wrap up here, is there some sort of barometer? Like how will you measure the success of HSU? Education is such a large component of this. So, you know, I'm not sure if that's, you know, really an apt question, but are there any, you know, built-in markers for that? Or, you know, what does that kind of look like behind the scenes?
So I would say there's not necessarily something, you know, there's not like a benchmark we're looking for. Our goal, like I said from the beginning, is to reduce collisions. So, every crash report that's done in the state is everything's tracked. So there's a database that we can actually look at and see the numbers in real time. You know, the way to measure that is do we actually start to see a decrease in those crashes, or do we start to see a decrease in fatals? Things like that would be the gauge. And if not, well, why not? Then we need to readdress some things.
Do you have anything to add to that, Corporal Briggs, as we wrap up?
It goes back to not as far as measured goals, but it goes back to our message and messages that we remind people of and that we get out quite a bit as far as traffic safety and safe driving tips, such as buckling up and making sure that everybody in the vehicle is wearing a seatbelt. Don't drive impaired. If you are impaired, make sure you have a ride sharing service. Drive the speed limit, leave safe distance between you and the other vehicles on the road. Keep an eye out for motorcyclists, bicyclists, and pedestrians. That goes along with the measurables that we have with reducing fatal crashes. Because as we all know, most crashes, all crashes and most fatal crashes are a result of those things that we remind people to don't drive impaired, wear your seatbelt, don't drive distracted. Those are very important things that we need to remind our motoring public of on a regular basis, because they, as I said, are what lead to crashes and fatal crashes.
Just to squeeze in one last question here, I'm curious, are there any Delaware-specific challenges like in keeping drivers safe on the roadway, roadways? Are there any challenges you think that are specific to Delaware as opposed to maybe other regions or states? Or do you find that these are essentially, you know, everyone's kind of dealing with the same kind of issues? It's not, you know, that much different.
I don't know about Corporal Briggs, but I'd say it's probably pretty consistent across all states. you know, with the technology, everybody's got a cell phone. Everybody's distracted by their cell phone when they're driving down the road. Just varies state to state on what, you know, some of the laws actually look like. Some states might let you be on your phone. Well, Delaware, you're not allowed to be on your phone while your vehicle's moving. So, you know, I would say they're probably all pretty similar. It's just to different degrees.
And to add what Sergeant McCann said, nothing unique to Delaware other than, at least here in Sussex County, like a lot of other places, Rehoboth Beach, Dewey Beach, the resort areas, that's a huge draw for the motoring public because it's within driving distance of quite a few places, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. So the traffic volume increases, as we saw this weekend, throughout the summer and into the fall season. Nothing unique other than the volume of traffic during the summer season.
Thanks to Sergeant Lloyd McCann and Master Corporal Lewis Briggs with the Delaware State Police and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we head to the University of Delaware to learn more about its efforts to expand its performing arts education program. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Performance arts education is expanding at the University of Delaware. For the first time, UD is combining its existing theater and dance minors into one unit, supported by the university's professional theater company, the Resident Ensemble Players. The change aims to ensure students have a high-quality performing arts experience at a time when programs at various schools around the country are being downsized, and some independent art institutions like Philadelphia's University of the Arts are being shut down. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Steve Tagg, UD's interim producing artistic director of the Resident Ensemble Players, joins Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel to chat about the school's performance arts education expansion.
Are you going against a tide, or are we, as the Europeans are doing, continuing to just raise education in the arts, raise it to a level that people understand this is critical to what we do as a civilized society?
I think it is. I think UD is, and I think actually the state of Delaware is moving against the general tide, because you're absolutely right. You know, there are, just in the last year, PAFA up in Philadelphia closed. DECAD
Delaware
closed.
College of Art and Design and the University of Arts in Philadelphia. Yes, absolutely.
And now that one, so all three of these closed, and you're like, wow. What's going on? Are we stepping out on the thin ice? I don't think so. Time will tell, but I think this part of my motivation here personally is to give young people a place, a path forward in life. A bunch of us went to a legislative function last month when we announced that we're having a theater major starting in 24, there was applause. I was like, oh my gosh, that was very surprising to us. The high school teachers reported, we're tired of sending our students out of the state. And I was like, well, we're happy to help you. We're happy to help them stay in the state. This is before I found out from the high schools or from the state arts organizations in Delaware that this was needed. I was interested in it because that was me. I was a kid in Nowheresville, Illinois, who had done plays in high school and didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I barely knew what college was, and I certainly didn't know that you could go in theater. And then various things fell into place, but fundamentally, I'm a kid from the cornfields. And I was like, wow. What about those kids from the chicken farms? Surely they must be sort of like me. So that's part of it. It's giving young people a path forward. And the second part, to specifically address what you're saying, is we feel, the faculty feels in dance and theater and the other arts, that we are particularly well equipped because of the nature of our disciplines, because they're so collaborative and so dependent upon clear communication, or at least compassionate communication, that those skills, collaboration and communication, apply anywhere. And as you say, to a decent civilization, let alone the product itself, let alone the drama, the dance, the painting, the symphony, which also it brings out the better side of us.
What's in the future?
So in the fall of 24, so in just a few months, we'll start a theater major, undergraduate, for the first time since, 89. And we're pretty well positioned. The reason, I think, partly the reason the university is in favor of this is we were fairly no cost, low cost to create this. So they're like, well, it sounds like a good proposal. And it's true. Most of the courses were already on the books. So we had to create a half dozen. I don't know what the real number is. Maybe it's more like 10 new courses, which is alone exciting. And we have, we think, the space to handle the influx of majors or students. But the question I kept having to ask myself is, God, do we really want to create another Bachelor of Theater degree? There must be bazillions of those across the country. And do we really need another one? In one respect, the answer is no. But in the other respect, as I have already covered, is that the Delaware doesn't have one. So those kids are going to go somewhere. And the other piece of it is the rep. There's no other place in the country where a student can come to a university and study theater, and in those classes be taught by the professionals of the professional equity theater on their campus, and at which at some point they will be integrated into at the undergraduate level. There are lots of those at the master's level, right? UC San Diego, Rutgers, Yale, Yale Rep, the old Globe. There are a number of them at the master's level, zero at the undergraduate level. So that is a one-of-a-kind thing in the U.S. right out of the gate. And I think for that for us will be a decent regional draw, but certainly a Delaware draw.
And you mentioned the rep, and that's a good segue into what I want to talk about next. And you kind of were talking about it, the idea of working with professional. And when we talk in the context we've been talking about, it's, oh, the students are going to benefit tremendously. One of the things that I hear from some of the best creative people I've had the fortune to talk to has been, I listen a lot. That's their secret. I keep my ears, eyes, everything open. I'm always taking in. And we think of the arts as projecting and putting out. So we feel sometimes, well, we're working with professionals, so they know all of the answers. But professionals can learn too, and they do day to day. And I think people that have been in the business benefit from younger blood that comes in with new versions of how to take this story on or this narrative. There's a dual learning. Have you observed that in just being a professional yourself and working?
Absolutely. There's no question on one of those tracks, the youth, and you say it very well, the stories of the young and the perspectives of the young. We all know that the symphony, the ballet, the theater, the art museums, they're all going to collapse and die if it's just for people over 60 that can't sustain itself. And we all know that. So, the Met in New York City, New York City Ballet, take your pick of museums and theater companies and ballet companies all over the country are, and I hate to say it this way, desperately trying to remake themselves because they got calcified, they got stuck. And they're just going to collapse on their own lack of audience before too long if they don't do what you're suggesting. And it's not only a survival mechanism, it's just the right thing to do. People need to see themselves in the art.
There's one final benefit that we can talk about in this theater and the musical and the arts in general, integrating themselves into our daily lives in ways that we are not always expecting. Can you tell us a little bit about how some of the minors might be beneficial to people that are, they want to dabble in theater or they did theater in their lives, but, you know, go ahead and get that major in what you wanted in social psychology or something important that you feel is going to make a statement in the world, but keep that foot in the arts and also use it. Are you seeing that application with students?
Yeah, we are. I mean, the minor program, the dance minor program here is pretty awesome. Those faculty have managed to create a very vital program, and it's largely as you describe it. These are nursing majors. These are neuroscience majors that grew up dancing, and they don't want to give it up. And so they continue. And as you suggest, it is good for their well-roundedness. It's like a liberal education. And dance used to be in PE, so it really is sort of a well-roundedness, right? You're taking care of the intellect, and you're also taking care of, you know, it's the whole mind-body thing. You're taking care of both in your 4 years here.
Thanks to UD's Steve Tagg and our Carl Lengel for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with History Matters and a look at a Delaware author's new book on the transformative years of a crucial military force once maligned as a flying club for veterans. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Air National Guard we know today, a crucial reserve sector of the U.S. Air Force, used to be known as nothing more than a flying club for World War II veterans. That was back during its early years in the mid-20th century. And in his new book, The Air National Guard, Delaware Air National Guard and U.S. Air Force veteran Brigadier General Kennard Wiggins Jr., chronicles how the Guard evolved into an operational force during the Korean War and the so-called Jet Age. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Brigadier General Wiggins to learn more about the Air National Guard's transformative years.
You've already written a plethora of history and military books. We spoke not too long ago about another then new book of yours, Delaware Patriot Heroes. And now you've published The Air National Guard, The Early Years, 1946 to 1965. Before we get into the minutiae of the book, though, I am curious, where did this idea come from? You know, and why write about the first two decades of the Air National Guard?
There's a fellow named David McAllister who was in my old Air Guard unit. And he died actually before I joined the unit. I never met the gentleman, but he had entered a thing called the Ricks Air Race in 1956, and he broke a speed record flying cross country, and he won the race that year and was acclaimed and all that sort of thing. And he was a sort of a local hero. But the best thing about McAllister was not only was he an aviator. His career dated back to World War II. He was a fighter pilot in World War II and so on. But he was also a writer, a fine writer, a very good writer. And I read his account of this race. And he must have enjoyed this race so much that he wrote three different versions. He wrote an extended story, I think, in Flying Magazine. He wrote a screenplay in case somebody wanted to try to make it into a movie. And I think he had like a third version. Each of the versions were just a little different in some of the details, but still it was a really, really cool story. So that got me interested in a thing called the Ricks Trophy Race, which was held by the Air National Guard from 1954 to the early 60s. And every year they would have a cross-country race and they would invite the different units. To me, it was a really interesting story. The purpose of these races at the time, the Air National Guard was brand new. It had only been in existence for, you know, maybe less than 10 years. And so they were trying to build support among the public. They were trying to convince the Air Force that they were capable partners. they were, you know, it was honestly, it was a public relations stunt, but it was well worthwhile. It was an interesting race that attracted a lot of attention at the time. And almost nobody knows anything about these races today, but at the time they were kind of a big deal. So the book started out as a story about air racing in the Air National Guard, but you kind of needed more. It wasn't much of a book. And so that's kind of the genesis of the book. And as I kept going, I added more and more pieces. I just began to collect these pieces and I put them together. It was kind of a mishmash, honestly. The dates are a little bit arbitrary. From 1946 is pretty easy. That's when the Guard started, but I had to cut it off someplace. So I cut it off in the mid 60s. And otherwise, it would just go on and on and on, you know.
Well, that I'm glad you brought up that so-called jet age, I believe, because I did make a note of that. It's something I don't think a lot of people are exactly aware of, but it truly is fascinating. I am curious, though, this next question, you're the perfect person to answer it. For those who aren't sure, who don't really know, as a Delaware Air National Guard and U.S. Air Force veteran, Ken, what exactly is the difference between the Air National Guard and Air Force active duty? What's the distinguishment there?
Well, the National Guard, just in general, is a state organization. In peacetime, the commander-in-chief is the governor of the state. In wartime, they can be federalized and they become a federal asset and they become part of the Air Force. If you're a member of the Air National Guard, you have a dual status. You're both federal if you're called and you're state if in normal terms. You might say, okay, what does the governor of some state need with F-16s? And, you know, why would a governor need, you know, fighter jets? And the point of the exercise there is it's not so much the jets themselves. Is typically a unit will have, say, 1,000 people. It'll have medics. It'll have engineers. It'll have nurses. It'll have, you know, all kinds of different skills. It'll have trucks. It'll have cots and beds and first aid equipment. So when the governor has an emergency and needs help during a hurricane or during a you know, some other natural disaster, you know, it's a great resource. Those folks can be called, you know, away from their desks or their jobs and brought back into service in the state to help out. And that's the primary difference. The Air National Guard is a reserve component of the Air Force. Although it is a reserve component of the Air Force, is also a state organization answerable to the governor. I hope that clarifies.
No, it clarifies. It clarifies, especially as someone who is the child of two Air Force veterans. I can. That makes sense. Adds up. But as far as the Air National Guard, then, how do we have an idea of how it was received when it was first created? Like, was it, you know, whether it's by the public, veterans or active service members, do we know if it was something that was taken seriously, or do we have an idea of how it was viewed?
Well, I think looking back at the history, actually during World War II, this was being discussed. What are we going to do after the war? How's this going to be set up? And of course, the Air Force hadn't been invented at that point. They were still part of the Army, but they were pretty confident that they were going to be an independent service after the war. And their vision was, if they were going to have a reserve component, it would be the Air Force Reserve. It would be a federal organization. And they pretty much resisted the idea of a National Guard air arm. But there were some pretty powerful voices speaking on behalf of the National Guard, including General Marshall, who was the chief of staff of the Army during World War II. He had served with National Guard units back in the 30s with the Civilian Conservation Corps and so on. And he had a lot of respect for the National Guard and what it could do. It's a hometown organization. And that gives it a certain kind of strength that nobody else can match. So, okay, with great reluctance, the Air Force had to accept this idea of an Air National Guard. What they did was they had a lot of surplus equipment. They had, you know, just fighter planes left over from World War II. And there were also thousands of veterans, combat veterans of World War II. So, you know, okay, well, we'll enlist these veterans and we'll give them these airplanes to fly and to maintain their proficiency and keep them ready to fly. And that's about all it amounted to. Some derisively called it a flying club, if you will, of veterans. And back in those days, they were flying, you know, pretty much obsolete equipment, but it was a way to keep the guys in the cockpit, keep them current. But things began to change relatively quickly. By the late 40s, the units were transitioning from their old World War II fighter planes into modern jets. You might say in some ways this tension between the active components and the reserve components over their reputation and their skill sets and so on. There's a sympathy, I think, on the active side that said, you know, those guys are amateurs. They're only weekenders. On the other side of that divide, we train to the same standards. We do all the same things the Air Force does, and there shouldn't be any difference. But today, I would say that the Air National Guard is a full partner in the total force with the Air Force and is recognized broadly and widely for its skills and the contribution it makes. But back in the early days, that was a tougher sell to make. And so it took time to gain the confidence of the Air Force.
It certainly didn't happen overnight, transforming from a so-called flying club, as you mentioned, to a full-fledged operational force that we know it as today. A big part of that transformation, 4 years after it was created, the Air National Guard was mobilized for the Korean War. What kind of impact did the Korean War have on the Guard and its growth and how it was generally viewed?
Well, most of the Air Guard units in the country were activated or federalized for the Korean War. The Guard is a sort of a unit-centered organization. They train together. They do everything together, and the hope and expectation is that the unit will be mobilized and sent off to do their job. And that was true in a few cases, a handful of cases. There were a couple of squadrons that were sent to Korea as squadrons, but for the most part, the Air Force used the Air National Guard as a sort of a manpower pool for replacements, individual replacements. So my unit, for example, the Delaware Air Guard, wasn't sent to Korea. It stayed home. But most of the pilots were picked and sent to Korea to fly with different Air Force organizations. So they used the skills, but they didn't use the unit, as it were. They used individuals. And that kind of left a sour taste in some folks' mouth about the way that was done. One of the other things that happened was a lot of these folks were World War II veterans. They had served in World War II 4 or 5 years earlier. Now they're activated for another war, and they sort of made a couple of decisions. Either they said, okay, when I'm done with this, I'm done. You know, I'm not going to do this again. I'm leaving. Or two, you know, I kind of like being in the Air Force again. I think I'll stay. And many of them stayed in the Air Force and never came home. So one result of that was there was a big impact on manpower in the Air Guard. We lost a lot of people. Not through casualties, but through resignations or the fact that people stayed in the Air Force. And so it had to rebuild itself after the war in terms of people and personnel. In terms of equipment, it did accelerate modernization again. You know, instead of the hand-me-down stuff, a lot of the units got newer and better airplanes as a result of the buildup for Korea and the surplus of airplanes afterwards.
Thanks to Delaware Air National Guard and U.S. Air Force veteran Brigadier General Kennard Wiggins Jr. and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.